From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Kennedy Center is in the middle of a Stephen Sondheim festival, reviving six of his musicals, including Follies, Company, Sunday in the Park with George, and Sweeney Todd. The Lincoln Center Festival is currently reviving Sondheim's musical Pacific Overtures. On today's Fresh Air, we listen back to interviews with Sondheim, and we hear from his frequent music director, Paul Gemignani. Also, film critic John Powers reviews Road to Perdition, directed by Sam Mendes, who also directed American Beauty. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The UN Security Council has averted a threat to UN peacekeeping. The Council unanimously adopted a resolution that temporarily shields U.S. peacekeepers from prosecution by the new International Criminal Court. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
The United States made a considerable concession to the rest of the Security Council in accepting the resolution. It tells the International Court to defer for 12 months any investigation or prosecution of peacekeepers from countries that don't recognize the court's jurisdiction. That includes the United States. Washington had been seeking blanket immunity for UN peacekeepers from the court, fearing that Americans could be targeted for political reasons. Washington threatened to veto UN peacekeeping missions as they came up for renewal if immunity weren't granted. The first mission that could have been affected was the UN peacekeeping operation in Bosnia. Its mandate expired on Monday. The U.S. was under considerable pressure to accept the compromise rather than jeopardize that and other UN missions. Vicki O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
The Senate has approved an amendment that would make it illegal for companies to give personal loans to their top executives and directors. The measure is part of a package of measures aimed at combating business fraud. The amendment would ban loans like the one President Bush received from Harkin Energy Corporation when he was a director of the company in the 1980s. During a speech on Wall Street this week, President Bush called on companies to voluntarily stop making such loans. Congressional appropriators from both parties angrily denounced a last-minute request from the White House Budget Office today. The White House wanted lawmakers to trim more than $1 billion from a bill giving additional funding for defense and homeland security. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
Senate and House appropriators angrily canceled a meeting after White House Budget Director Mitch Daniels told them to trim $1.1 billion from the $30 billion spending bill, which President Bush says is urgently needed. The chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, Democrat Robert Byrd, had this to say.
Upon what meat doth this our little Caesar feed? I'm talking about Mitch Daniels.
And the Republican chair of the House Appropriations Committee, Bill Young, warned that without the supplemental, the Army may run out of funds next week.
The Army will be standing down some training, which I don't want to happen. And I'm surprised that the director of OMB is willing to let that happen just because of a lack of cooperation and communication.
White House officials have threatened the spending bill could be vetoed if it's too big. David Wallner, NPR News, the Capitol.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 117 points to close at 8,684 in heavy trading. For the week, the Dow was down 695 points. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost about a point to close at 1,373, down 75 for the week. This is NPR News. Prosecutors in Cleveland are asking a judge to send Congressman James Traficant to prison for more than 7 years. The Ohio Democrat was convicted on bribery and other corruption charges, and he's scheduled to be sentenced at the end of this month. Federal prosecutors filed court papers today arguing that Traficant had shown no remorse and had tried to shift blame for his crimes by accusing federal agencies of misconduct. Traficant faces up to 63 years in prison. The heat wave that has scorched the western U.S. for the last few days is easing up, but officials in California are now warning of a heightened wildfire danger. Joe Barr reports from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento.
Temperatures are a few degrees lower today in the west, but Karen Terrell with the California Department of Forestry says the heat wave has only worsened tinder-dry conditions.
Virtually all of California is quite dry. The far south part of the state is the worst of the drought, but certainly the northern part of the state, the grass out there is ready to burn.
Terrell calls the next 24 hours critical because the weather is ripe for dry lightning storms in the Sierra Nevada and the foothills. Dry lightning strikes yesterday caused 10 small wildfires, which were brought under control quickly. Terrell says the CDF is prepared for the worst and has sent additional bulldozers, helicopters, and firefighters to the region. For NPR News, I'm Joe Barr in Sacramento.
Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill is scheduled to visit Argentina and Brazil later this month in an effort to get a better understanding of the two nations' troubled economies. Argentina is currently trying to revive its economy after a four-year recession. Britain's currency and its stock market are in turmoil. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Wellington Management, providing investment advice to clients worldwide, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Something familiar, something peculiar, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Something appealing, something appalling, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Nothing with kings, nothing with crowns. Bring on the lovers, liars, and clowns. Old situations, new complications, nothing portentous or polite. Tragedy tomorrow, comedy tonight.
That's Comedy Tonight from A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, the first Broadway musical with music and lyrics by Stephen Sondheim. He is America's greatest living music theater composer and among the best who ever lived. The Kennedy Center is in the middle of a Sondheim celebration, reviving six of his musicals, Sweeney Todd, Company, Sunday in the Park with George, Merrily We Roll Along, Passion, and A Little Night Music. This weekend, the Lincoln Center Festival is concluding its revival of Sondheim's musical Pacific Overtures. We're going to hear from Sondheim and his frequent music director, Paul Gemignani. We begin with comments Sondheim made at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York during their 1993 retrospective of his work for television. When Sondheim was a teenager, his mentor was lyricist Oscar Hammerstein, who was also a neighbor and friend of the family. Sondheim said he was encouraged by Hammerstein to avoid imitation and find his own voice.
When I was first writing love songs, so at the age of 18, I would write about larks learning to pray. And, he would say to me, but you know, you don't believe this stuff. I said, no, but it, I mean, what, he said, what do you feel about it? I said, well, I don't know. He said, have you ever been in love? I said, no. He said, well, then you have to try to get inside the character that you're writing for. But don't write what I write. Write what you write. Then he said something really smart. He said, and if you do that, he said, you'll be 90% ahead of everybody else. And as soon as he put it on a competitive level, a little click went off my head, you know? But what he meant was that most people do not write for character. They write, or even out of their own hearts, at least in the musical theater in those days. He was one of the few who did. They wrote according to a sort of standard set of feelings, you know, it used to be called pop song feelings, it used to be called June Moon feelings. Oscar was one of the few people who understood writing for character, and that's what he was telling me to do. And that lesson probably was the single most valuable one I ever learned.
Stephen Sondheim recorded in 1993 at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York. Sondheim got his start writing lyrics for Leonard Bernstein's music for the show West Side Story. Before we hear a 1988 interview I recorded with Sondheim, let's listen to the Jet song from West Side Story.
When you're a jet, all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day. When you're a jet, if the spit hits the fan, you got brothers around, you're a family man. You're never alone, you're never disconnected. You're home with your own, when company's expected, you're well protected.
Then you are set with a capital J, which you'll never forget till they cart you away. When you're a jet, you stay a
In 1988, Stephen Sondheim told me that he didn't like the idea of starting his Broadway career as a lyricist.
No, I was trained as a composer, and that's what I wanted to do. I'd majored in music, and I'd studied music on a scholarship with Milton Babb for 2 years. And it was an accident, and I wouldn't have done it except that Oscar thought it was a good idea for me to do it, because Bernstein and Jerry Robbins and Arthur Lawrence were seasoned professionals, and I was, you know, 25 years old, and he thought it would be a good learning experience for me. And he was right.
Those are the first lyrics you wrote that got performed on Broadway. They've become classics. When you listen back to them, how do you feel about them?
I didn't like them then, and I don't like them now. And there are two lyrics I like. The rest of them sound very written to me.
Which ones are the ones that you like?
Something's Coming and the Jet Song. The others are, you know, they're very self-conscious. But that was partly Lenny's influence, because he very much wanted the show to be important, and that to him important meant that the lyrics should be, quote, poetic, and his idea of poetic and mine are different, and I think what he really wanted was purple prose, and I wanted simplicity, which is what I'd gotten from Oscar. So I think the lyrics are very self-conscious. I was bending over to please everybody, of course, because I was so young, and so I find, you know, except for the occasional line, I think they're pretty embarrassing.
You worked with Julie Stein on Gypsy. You wrote the lyrics.
That was the next show, yes.
Now, in his autobiography, he said one of the things he liked about working with you is that you never asked for extra notes. does that mean, like, if you find a three-syllable word that you think is just perfect, that you beg the composer for two extra notes?
No, well, no, this is, no, actually, no. I think. first of all, most of the lyrics in Gypsy, the music sort of followed the lyrics. That say, I would write sample quatrains or couplets and give them rhythms to work from. In fact, I'd never do that anyway. When I work with a composer, I've only worked with three. But in West Side Story, I asked for extra syllables. I mean, a number of the tunes in West Side Story were taken out of Candide that were not used in Candide. One of them was a song called One, which was composed of dotted half notes, and it went one hand, one heart. But I said, when we got to Washington, I said, it's just too few notes there, and the words just too heavy and too pretentious, and at least, you know, if you give me three-quarter notes instead of one dotted half, I would appreciate it. Well, the lyric's still pretty pretentious, but it's not as pretentious as it was. Maybe Julie had that from other people. I don't believe in, though, like everybody else, I often tend to be verbose when I write lyrics. I try to fight against it. And I remember Oscar used to set me exercises in theory and say, you know, write a whole note melody and a whole note lyric. A whole note meaning, you know, where you have to sustain a note. Like he wrote a song called Who with Jerome Kern. When you, who stole my heart away. Well, if you hear that tune, it's hard to set that lyric, because you've got to find a word where the singer can sustain the vowel sound and where it's natural punctuation, and it's hard to do. And I think most lyric writers tend to be verbose, and I think that's what Julie was probably referring to, was that, you know, I'd been trained quite the reverse way. Not that there aren't wordy lyrics in Gypsy, but there aren't very many of them.
When you started writing your own music, did you feel like you were carrying on the tradition of Rodgers and Hammerstein in any way, or did you feel like you were breaking from them?
Oh, no, it was Rodgers and Hammerstein, certainly, absolutely.
What about what they had done felt like what you were doing? What is the tradition exactly?
Oh, it's a tradition. It's something Oscar really started with Showboat. It's he combined the whole European operetta idea with the American musical comedy idea. And the American musical comedy idea was, you know, a series of songs with jokes in between, and the operetta idea was a series of, you know, Graustarkian situations with outlandish romantic variations on them, and essentially an excuse for singers to let forth with large romantic or choral pieces. And with Showboat, he attempted to bring some realism into the musical theater and to combine the two so that they became what you could call a musical play. Not an opera, but a musical play. And somewhere between an operetta and a musical comedy. And
That was not taken up very much by other people during the 30s, and Oscar tried a few himself, and they failed. So it wasn't until Oklahoma came along and was such a gigantic success that the movement was resuscitated. And after that, virtually everybody started to write what they call integrated musicals, in which the songs carry the story forward instead of just being respites and moments between jokes and block comedy scenes. And that's essentially what I was doing.
I want to play one piece that you've written, and this is from your opera, Sweeney Todd. And I thought it might be interesting to...
It's nice to call it an opera, but please, let's call it a musical.
Call it a musical. Yeah, why would you prefer that to opera?
Well, because it doesn't belong in an opera house. Though it's mostly sung, there's a good deal of dialogue in it, and I'd say about 20% is dialogue. And it's not for operatic voices. It's not about the singer. Operas are about the singer, not about the opera.
Yeah, why don't you like to write for operatic voices, by the way?
Because they push it. They're interested in the voice and not in the material. And I'm interested in the material. And that's just the way they're trained, and that's what audiences come to hear. Audiences do not come to hear the piece, they come to hear the singers.
Well, from Sweeney Todd, what I've chosen to play is a part called The Epiphany, and this is a part where the whole character of the main character changes. Throughout the show, he's been interested in revenge against one person, and it's a kind of just revenge that he's seeking. But when his revenge is thwarted, he becomes pathological and is interested in killing anybody who enters his barbershop. He'll take any head that walks in. This is a turning point. Before we hear it, just tell me a little bit about the challenge that writing this presented to you.
Well, the piece is based on a play by an English playwright named Christopher Bond, an excellent version of this story, which has been told for 130 years, 1830 long, 150 now. And it's always been a kind of 19th-century melodrama with blood and guts and thunder sheets. And as such, it was always very uninteresting till this young playwright, Christopher Bond, a British playwright, got hold of it in the 70s. He was with an acting troupe, and they were going to put it on for their Christmas show. And they read it. The scripts arrived a little late, and they read it, and they only had 3 weeks to go, and they realized how terrible even the last version was, which would have been, I think, 1956 was the last version that was written. So he said, don't worry about it, I'll rewrite it. And he rewrote it, and he changed, kept the essential plot, which is about a murderer, mass murderer, and who kills people in his barber chair, and whose colleague, Mrs. Lovett, turns them into meat pies and becomes the most successful entrepreneur of meat pies in London as a result. And he motivated it by giving Sweeney Todd this whole revenge motive, which was never, ever part of the story. And the only difficulty he had in motivating the whole play was turning the personal revenge into mass revenge, which, of course, didn't matter in the originals, because in the originals he was just this kind of crazed, greedy murderer who killed people for their money. And that was not the case with Bond's version. And I had to figure out some reason to justify the moment. Bond justified the moment with a single sentence, which even he admitted was sort of a weak stem, which Sweeney said, in effect, I've tasted blood and now my thirst is great. And I'd never bought that, and neither, I think, did Chris Bond. So I tried to think of a reason that he would turn from being a single-minded murderer into this kind of crazed mass murderer. And I came up with this notion in The Epiphany, which has to do with the social situation and really has to do with the lower classes and the upper classes, which is something that Bond, who was and is a sort of left-wing playwright, had touched on but hadn't used for this particular moment. And what Sweeney does, in effect, is blame the world for his difficulties, for his problems, for the rape and suicide of his wife. And, in fact, he's right. And so to blame the social structure for his personal tragedy gave me the key so that he could then say, and now I will kill everybody in the social structure, high and low. And that's what it amounts to.
There's a hole in the world like a great black pit, and it's filled with people who are filled with shit, and the vermin of the world inhabit it. But not for long. They all deserve to die. Tell you why, Mrs. Love, tell you why. Because Because in all of the whole human race, Mrs. Lovett, there are two kinds of men and only two. There's the one staying put in his proper place and the one with his foot in the other one's face. Look at me, Mrs. Lovett, look at you. Now we all deserve to die. Tell you why, Mrs. Lovett, tell you why. Because the lives of the wicked should be made brief for the rest of us. Death will be a relief. We all deserve to die. And I'll never see Joanna. No, I'll never hug my girl to be finished. All right, you, sir. How about a shave? Come and visit your good friend, Sweeney. You, sir, too, sir, welcome to the grave. I will have vengeance. I will have salvation. Who, sir? You, sir? No one's in the chair. Come on, come on! Sweeney's waiting. I want you, waiters. You, sir, anybody, gentlemen, now don't be shy. Not one man, no, nor 10 men, nor 100 can assuage me. I will have you. And I will get him back, even as he gloats. In the meantime, I'll practice on less honorable throats. And my Lucy lies in ashes, and I'll never see my girl again. But the work waits. I'm alive at last, and I'm full.
Len Carreyrou from the original cast recording of Stephen Sondheim's musical Sweeney Todd. We'll hear more of Sondheim's 1988 interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. The Kennedy Center is in the middle of a Sondheim celebration, reviving six of his musicals. This weekend, the Lincoln Center Festival is concluding its revival of his musical Pacific Overtures. Let's get back to our 1988 interview with Sondheim.
You know, it seems to me that in all your songs, you always bring in very specific elements of the drama that's going on.
Yes, well, I'm into that. I'm into sort of naturalistic songwriting. And like in The Worst Pies in London, in that show, you know, I worked out where she's dusting, blowing dust off her pies and slapping roaches and things like that. It's all worked into the music, each slap and each blow. And I like working that kind of thing in. It first of all, it helps the director to give him a very specific blueprint of what the action should be, so that if he wants to change it, he can, but he has something to work from, and he doesn't have to turn to you and say, well, how do I fill this moment? And I like to, I think it's fun to write songs, you know, for people who have colds or who stutter or, you know, who cough or who can't remember what they're saying, the kinds of things we do in real life.
Is that why you like to work in the setting of Broadway shows, because there are details of a story to work into a song? It's not just a generic love song. There's characters.
Oh, yeah, sure. That's exactly why, yes. I'd much rather write for character and situation. I wouldn't know how to just write a song, because I would have to invent a character in a situation if you asked me to write a song. The few songs I've written, like, for, I don't know, people's birthdays and things like that, that I've written apart from dramatic situations, I've had to invent the dramatic situation or take it out of a real-life situation.
Have you ever taken a lyric of yours and changed it because you thought it was too clever?
No, I've taken it, yes, I have, when I think the audience isn't getting it, or when I think it's out of character. I did it in Into the Woods. There was a nice couplet in a song called No More, and it was very graceful, and it was too graceful for the character. Yes, I will take it out sometimes, not often, because I usually do that in my study while I'm writing it. when I think that it's either out of character or when I think that it may be something difficult for the audience to assimilate quickly, because the whole point of a song is, as opposed to a poem, which you can read at your own speed, the lyric goes by at its speed and you have to catch up with it. So it's up to the lyric writer and the composer to make it clear to the audience, at the same time not lag behind them nor be so far ahead of them that they get baffled. So sometimes you have to underwrite lyrics for just that purpose. You have to give them air and you have to make the lyrics simpler than you would if it was on paper.
I know that you collect puzzles and you're interested in puzzles. Is lyric writing similar to a puzzle?
Oh, sure.
And the problems you have to solve?
All art is. All you have to solve it. Same thing as with a painting or with a novel. I mean, you're always solving problems of structure, architecture, and things like that. In lyrics, I think it's more critical because there are so many fewer words. I don't know what kind of a... I just violated some basic speech. So many fewer words. But anyway, there are fewer words. And therefore, each one becomes important. Also, since I believe in writing lyrics that reflect the inflection of regular speech, the rise and fall of the language, and how long you sustain a word in a given line becomes, to my ear anyway, critical if you're trying to give the impression of naturalistic speech. One of the problems with Sweeney Todd was I didn't want the audience to laugh at this melodrama. I mean, we do live in the 20th century, and people don't go for this kind of blood and thunder stuff anymore, and it's much more horrible out on the street than it is on the stage. But I also didn't want them to think that they were, quote, at an opera. So one of the triumphs for me of Sweeney Todd is I look around the second act at the audience's face. They don't know that people are singing. They really think they're talking because they're so involved with the story and what's going to happen next and who's going to get killed next. They don't realize they're being sung at. And that's a result of lyric writing being so seeming like dialogue. And that kind of stuff comes through a lot of sweat. And that's what working out a puzzle is.
Stephen Sondheim recorded in 1988. We'll hear a more recent interview with him in the second half of the show. The Kennedy Center is currently reviving Sondheim's musical Merrily We Roll Along. Here's the best-known song from it. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Hey, old friend, are you okay? Old friend, what do you say? Old friend, are we or are we unique? Time goes by, everything else keeps changing. You and I, we get continued next week. Most friends fade or they don't make the grade. New ones are quickly made, and in a pinch, sure they'll do. But us, old friend, what's to discuss? Old friend, here's to us, who's like us, damn few. So, old friends, fill me in slow. Old friend, start from hello.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Delta Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Mother Rocket, a collection of stories by Rita Cerisi, author of Pink Slip. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more from Stephen Sondheim, and we hear from his frequent music director, Paul Gemignani. Also, film critic John Powers reviews Road to Perdition, starring Tom Hanks and Paul Newman.
We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Kennedy Center is in the middle of a Stephen Sondheim festival reviving six of his theater musicals. This weekend, the Lincoln Center Festival concludes its revival of Sondheim's musical Pacific Overtures. Before we hear more from Sondheim, we're going to hear from music director Paul Gemignani. He's worked with Sondheim since 1973 on such musicals as A Little Night Music, Sweeney Todd, Pacific Overtures, Sunday in the Park with George, Merrily We Roll Along, and Passion. Gemignani was also the music director of Crazy for You and the revivals of Brigadoon and Kiss Me, Kate. 2 years ago, he won a Tony Award for Lifetime Achievement. In his role as music director, Gemignani helps cast the performers and hire the orchestra. He rehearses the musicians and singers and is the liaison between the composer and the rest of the company. During performances, he conducts the musicians and singers. Gemignani says he particularly enjoyed serving as music director on Sondheim's Sweeney Todd. Here's the overture.
Attend the tale of Sweeney Todd. His skin was pale and his eye was odd. Shaved the faces of gentlemen who never thereafter were heard of again. He trod a path that few have trod, did Sweeney Todd, a demon barber of Fleet Street.
He kept a shop in London town of fancy clients and good renown. What if none of their souls were saved? They went to their maker impeccably shaved. By Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street.
In Sweeney Todd, I think the first that sound we hear is that steam whistle, a really discordant, shrill, alarming steam whistle that certainly sets the tone for, you know, a musical that's about very alarming thoughts and feelings and actions, including murder and revenge. Did you actually have a steam whistle in the orchestra?
What happened was, it said in the opening thing on the top, it said whistle. Factory whistle is what it said. So we sat down and had discussions about what a factory whistle was. And I said, well, you mean the kind that has, like, thing that popped into my mind is those old English factory movies, or you know, like Dirk Bogart movies, where he's in a blue-collar section of somewhere in Britain, and his father works in the mines or in the factory, and on the top of that factory is this whistle that's actually worked from steam, right? Pretty shrill sounding. And it was there for exactly what you said it was there for, shock value, and to start a musical about revenge.
Where did you find the factory whistle?
I didn't. The sound man did. I went to the sound designer, and I said, I need a factory whistle. And he said, you mean the kind that I said, no, I mean the steam kind that go on the top of a building. So where am I going to find that? I said, oh, no, that's your job. So he did. He brought several back, and actually what we did in rehearsal, I remember the first day that he brought that in, and we hooked it up to a CO2 canister in the front of the stage, and I said, well, do you want me to play this? And he said, well, how loud is it? I said, I have no idea, I've never heard it. And he said, well, let's play it. And I played it. It's like we almost all passed out from the sound. But it did what it was supposed to do.
You had worked with Harold Prince and Stephen Sondheim, from the start of your career as a music director, through the time that Sondheim and Harold Prince split up in the early '80s after the box office failure of Merrily We Roll Along. What did it mean for you when Sondheim and Harold Prince split up?
I had to choose. It wasn't an easy choice. I have a great deal of respect for both men. I love both men. They gave me my career, so it was not an easy choice to make. But I went with Steve because of the musical connection and how connected I feel to Steve's material and work. And, you know, you don't meet many people in your life that artistically you feel connected with, or you feel like you're supposed to be there and you're supposed to be doing what you're doing with this person. Steve is one of those people for me. He's the person for me in that respect when it comes to music.
Can you think of a moment in a musical that you conducted where every night you'd say to yourself, this is what it's about for me. This is the kind of musical feeling, the kind of Broadway feeling that I live for?
I have to say Sunday in the Park. I have to say when Mandy and Bernadette sing We Do Not Belong Together, that's a moment that popped into my mind when you asked me that question. I'm sure there's 1,000 others, but, you know, working the 12 years I worked with Steve and Hal, I don't have to work anymore after that. I mean, all the thrill and all the expectations I had as an artist were fulfilled in that 12 years. Am I tired of working now? No. And will I continue until I can't work anymore? Absolutely. I'm just saying that, you know, I feel kind of greedy at this point because I've had such great experience and great times in the past and had an opportunity to do so much artistically because of those two guys that, you know, everything else is gravy. But that one place in Sunday in the Park sticks in my mind.
Let's listen to that duet between Mandy Patinkin and Bernadette Peters from Sunday in the Park with George.
Yes, George, run to your work. Hide behind your painting. I've come to tell you I am leaving because I thought you might care. You know, foolish of me, because you care about nothing.
I care about many things.
Things? Not people.
People, too. I cannot divide my feelings up as neatly as you. And I am not hiding behind my canvas. I am living in it.
But you care for it yourself.
I care for this painting. You will be in this painting.
I have something you can use.
I had thought you would destroy.
Because I understand that I left that.
And there's nothing I can say, is there?
Yes, George, there is. You could tell me not to go. Say it to me. Tell me not to go. Tell me that you're hurt. Tell me you're relieved. Tell me that you're bored, anything, but don't assume I know. Tell me what you feel.
What I feel? You know exactly how I feel. Why do you insist you must hear the words when you know I cannot give you words? Not the ones you need. There's nothing to say. I cannot be what you want.
What do you want, George?
I needed you, and you left.
There was no room for me.
You will not accept who I am. I am what I do, which you knew, which you always knew, which I thought you were a part of.
No, you are complete, George. You are your own. We do not belong together. You are complete, George. You all alone. I am unfinished. I am diminished. With or without you, we do not belong together. And we should have belonged together. What made it so right together?
That's We Do Not Belong Together from Sunday in the Park with George. Conducting that was one of music director Paul Gemignani's favorite Broadway experiences. I asked him to think of another.
The first thing that Sweeney sings in Sweeney Todd to his razors, that moment sticks in my mind.
Friends?
Friends, yeah.
This is the moment when the barber Sweeney Todd, who's been put in prison, is out of prison. He's seeking revenge against the judge who locked him up and shouldn't have. And the judge is now planning to marry Sweeney's daughter. It's an ugly story. but finally, Sweeney's reunited with his razors, and he's going to use them not only to be a barber but to take his revenge. And he sings this beautiful song about how he's reunited with his friends, but what he's really thinking about is revenge.
Right.
What's so wonderful about this moment for you conducting it?
Well, the beauty of the music and the irony of the idea. You know, it gives you something to perform. It's not, you know, it's not 32 bars in 4/4 time. It's, you know, a beautiful melody in an intense dramatic moment that's taking the story from one place to another. That is the theater to me.
These are my friends. See how they glisten. See this one shine. How he smiles in the light. My friend, my faithful friend. Speak to me, friend. Whisper, I'll listen. I know you've been locked out of sight all these years. Like me, my friend. Well, I've come home.
Come, oh, let Mr. me Todd, hold you. If you only knew, Mr. Todd, oh, Mr. Todd,
you're warm in my hand, my friend, my clever friend.
Always had a fondness for you, I did.
Rest now, my friend.
Never you fear,
soon
Mr.
I'll
Todd.
Unfold.
You can move in here, Mr. Todd.
Splendors
you
never
have
dreamed
of.
Music from Sweeney Todd. We heard from Paul Gemignani, music director for most of Stephen Sondheim's original Broadway productions. Coming up, more from Stephen Sondheim. This is Fresh Air. This weekend, the Lincoln Center Festival is concluding its revival of the Stephen Sondheim musical Pacific Overtures, and the Kennedy Center is in the middle of a Sondheim festival reviving six of his musicals. The growing number of theater revivals is one of the subjects I spoke about with Sondheim 2 years ago. The musical theater is becoming more and more devoted to repertory, and several of your shows have had, I'm glad to say, new productions. What do you think of that trend? I mean, it's been great for your shows because it's enabled us to go see them again or see them for the first time if we miss them the first time around. And it's, I think, been particularly good because some musicals like Merrily We Roll Along, which didn't stay on Broadway for long, the new productions have been a great opportunity to actually see it. But you know, in the larger scheme of things, what do you think of the emphasis now on revivals?
Oh, it's deplorable because young writers aren't getting a chance to get their work heard, at least on Broadway. But that's been going on for years. It isn't just the revivals. producers are, because musicals are so expensive, are very unwilling to take chances on unknown writers unless the project that they're writing for is a pre-sold project, meaning a hit movie
like The Lion King or something.
Yeah, exactly. Or The Full Monty that's coming along, which is a writer new to Broadway. And I doubt if he had written a show that nobody had ever heard, the title of which nobody had ever heard of, that he would have gotten a chance. People, producers just are unwilling. I can understand why, because musicals are so expensive to put on. But it's terrible because the only way you learn to write is by writing a show or writing songs and having the show put on and then writing another one and putting it on and writing another one and putting it on. That's the only way you learn. And you learn, you get better through experience, not through theory. And even the writers who manage to get a show on don't get another show on for years afterwards. And so they improve themselves very slowly. And if they get a chance at all, that's what's terrible about it.
I'm wondering if you think it's difficult to find good Broadway singers now. It sometimes strikes me as a form of singing that's almost dying out, I think in part because most people don't grow up listening to Broadway singing. They grow up listening to pop or rock, hip-hop, and it's just different approach to singing.
You're absolutely right. When people come in to audition, we often have to ask, particularly younger people, to just sing the song straight instead of stylizing them, instead of bending the notes, instead of doing the kinds of styles you're talking about. They tend to sing mostly very loud and all at one level of expression, and which is pretty boring on a stage and fine for a concert. And also, it's inhuman. That is, say, it has nothing to do with character, since they stylize so much when they sing that the character is lost. So we often have to ask them please to sing it straight. Meaning, for some of them, that's very hard to do. They can't just sing the notes. They can only fool around with the notes. And a lot of them have faulty sense of pitch, and it's revealed when they have to sing the song straight. But since most Broadway shows require a much more straightforward kind of vocal sound and vocal production and vocal style than pop and rock, you're absolutely right. It's harder to find them. On the other hand, there are plenty of good voices and a lot of good talent around.
Do you find that there are certain intervals that you have in your songs or anything else that gives singers a lot of trouble, that they're not used to it?
No. I hear secondhand complaints that my songs are difficult to sing, but very few firsthand complaints from people who actually sing them. I think what happens is that I write a lot of dissonance in the accompaniment, and though it's mild dissonance, it's still dissonance, and there will be a chord or a line of counterpoint in the music that will clash directly with the note being sung, and a lot of people have trouble hearing the note they're supposed to sing when the chord that's being played or the contrapuntal line that's being played clashes. There's never any problem with a trained singer, but with untrained singers, that often happens. On the other hand, once they get used to it and see the reason I've chosen those notes, which often has to do with inflection and sometimes with harmonic resolution, the difficulties usually melt away. The people who have difficulty even after, when they're in rehearsal, usually have difficulty with lyrics, particularly with some of the faster lyrics I write and some of the patter lyrics. And I will, if I see that the singer is in difficulty, sometimes it's my fault, and I will take a word out or change a phrase to make it easier on the teeth and the tongue or the lungs.
Well, a good example of that patter song is Not Getting Married, which is maybe one of the wordiest songs ever written. It's amazing somebody could
do it. It's wordy, but it's not hard to sing. And what's hard is the melody, because the melody is comprised mainly of half steps. And unless the voice and the ear are good, the singer gets into a kind of Sprechstimme, a kind of semi-talking. But the patter itself is written pretty carefully, though the last section, I think, there are some breathing problems, and it's a lyric I should improve. But most of it sings very well, and what most singers don't understand is that the faster you sing it, the easier it is.
Why is that?
Because less breath is required. And when people sing it slower, they tend to punch certain of the heavy consonants like P's and B's and expend breath that should be better preserved for finishing the phrase in one breath. If you listen to V.N. Cox singing Getting Married Today on the recording of the show that was done by the Roundabout Theater in New York, you'll hear absolutely split-second timing, and she sings it faster than I guess anybody else has ever sung it, and you get every word, and she has no trouble at all.
Why don't we hear it? Here it is.
Listen, everybody, look, I don't know what you're waiting for. A wedding, what's a wedding? It's a prehistoric ritual where everybody promises fidelity forever, which is maybe the most horrifying word I ever heard, and which is followed by a honeymoon where suddenly you'll realize he's saddled with a net and want to kill me, which you should. So listen, thanks a bunch, but I'm not getting married. Go have lunch, because I'm not getting married. You've been grand, but I'm not getting married. Don't just stand there, I'm not getting married. And don't tell Paul, but I'm not getting married today. Go, can't you go? Why is nobody listening? Goodbye, go and cry at another person's wake. If you're quick for a kick, you could pick up a christening, but please, on my knees, there's a human life at stake. Listen, everybody, I'm afraid you didn't hear. Do you want to see a crazy lady fall apart in front of you? It isn't only Paul who may be ruining his life. You know, we'll both of us be losing our identities. I telephoned my analyst about it, and he said to see you Monday, but by Monday I'll be floating in the Hudson with the other garbage. I'm not well, so I'm not getting married. You've been swell, but I'm not getting married. Clear the hall, because I'm not getting married. Thank you all, but I'm not getting married. And don't tell Paul, but I'm not getting married today.
Our interview with Stephen Sondheim was recorded 2 years ago. This weekend, the Lincoln Center Festival concludes its revival of Sondheim's Pacific Overtures, and the Kennedy Center continues its Sondheim Festival with a revival of Merrily We Roll Along. Coming up, John Powers reviews the new film Road to Perdition. This is Fresh Air. The new movie Road to Perdition stars Tom Hanks, Paul Newman, and Jude Law. It's the second film directed by Sam Mendes. He won an Oscar for directing the 1999 film American Beauty. Film critic John Powers has a review of Road to Perdition.
The late film critic Pauline Kael once wrote a famous essay called Trash, Art, and the Movies. It argued that quite often, trashy movies aren't just enjoyable, but are actually artful, while movies that make a big point out of being art are often little more than joyless rubbish. I thought about her words as I watched the peculiar new movie Road to Perdition, an Oedipal tale of the crime business that puts a highbrow spin on a lowbrow story, which may be another way of saying it feels designed to win Oscars. It's 1931 in the wintry Midwest, and a bulked-up mustachioed Tom Hanks is Michael Sullivan, an efficient hitman for a big-shot gangster named John Rooney. That's Paul Newman. Sullivan's sons don't know what he does for a living, until one night 12-year-old Mike Jr. sees his father and Rooney's son Connor slaughter a guy. The bloodthirsty Connor's afraid the kid won't keep his mouth shut, so he tries to kill the whole Sullivan family. But he only kills Sullivan's wife and other son, and soon the two surviving Sullivans hit the road, heading to the small town of Perdition, the symbolism of whose name should penetrate even the thickest of skulls. While Sullivan schemes to avenge his wife's murder, Rooney hires a hitman, played by Jude Law, to stop him. And even as everyone is stalking everyone else, Sullivan must learn to love the worshipful Mike Jr., who's adjusting to his discovery that his old man's a killer. Early on, Sullivan and Rooney discuss how young Mike is dealing with seeing his dad in murderous action.
How is Michael? Is he okay?
I've spoken to him. He understands.
That's tough, seeing that for the first time. well you turned out. You can't protect them forever. If it wasn't this, it'd be something else. Natural law. Sons are put on this earth to trouble their fathers.
Road to Perdition is the second film by Sam Mendes, the British theater director who won the Oscar for his debut, American Beauty. I always wondered if that movie's real creative force was screenwriter Alan Ball. And Ball has subsequently gone on to create 6 Feet Under, a brilliant TV show that's far, far better than American Beauty. And Mendes? Well, here he seems to be feeling the pressure of that Oscar. For Road to Perdition fairly shrieks, "This is serious art. This is a prestige picture." Which is very odd, for its plot could easily come from a B-movie from the 40s or 50s. It's got all the elements of pulp. A good hitman battling two bad ones, questions of loyalty to the gangster code, and a blatant father-son theme that's always being underscored, the way Newman's character did just a moment ago. Yet there's not a second when this feels like a gritty crime movie. Instead, Mendes seems to be self-consciously trying to elevate an old-fashioned gangster story into something with the resonance of myth. Trouble is, this has already been done much better by pictures like The Godfather and Once Upon a Time in America, which dug into their characters' passions, dreams, and betrayals. Here, the characters are too nakedly iconic to be compelling, which leaves everything up to the cast. Law's performance as a photographer hitman is an amusing piece of pop kabuki acting, and Newman is coolly authoritative as a paternal Irishman who will beat his son at one moment, then hug him the next. But while Tom Hanks deserves credit for trying to shake off his halo, he's not really convincing as an enforcer. He's often called the new Jimmy Stewart, but where Stewart wasn't afraid to let madness and hysteria fray the edges of his gee-whiz amiability, Hanks never conveys Sullivan's ruthless ferocity. He makes the hitman seem like a lumbering and doleful plumber, rather than a killer burning with the need for revenge. Then again, the whole movie lacks the ferocity and snap that made us like gangster movies in the first place. Rather like the Coen brothers in Miller's Crossing, Mendes has painstakingly aestheticized everything. Every shot is lingeringly well lit. Unpainted barns and dank streets have never looked more gorgeous, but you wind up feeling as if you've been force-fed buckets of frosting. And the scenes themselves are played portentously, like this, because every moment is very, very meaningful. If Mendes had simply kept things clipping along at the proper speed, the whole movie would race by in about 65 minutes, and it would be good, trashy fun. As it is, Road to Perdition lumbers along with the slow, heavy steps of a white elephant, walking the road to pretension.
John Powers is executive editor and media columnist for LA Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed today's show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Just tell my false-hearted lover that the whale will watch over me.
On the next Fresh Air, bluegrass pioneer Ralph Stanley. His career was revived by his performance on the soundtrack of O Brother, Where Art Thou? He has a new CD. Join us for the next Fresh Air.